Welcome today to an interview series with Outstanding Professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm speaking with Joanne Maleski, Principal Consultant, ThoughtWorks. Joanne, you have this really interesting, diverse background. It's really quite amazing. So thank you for coming in today and sharing your work and experiences with our audience.
Oh, you're welcome, Steve.
Now, Joanne, what has changed in technology use over the last 5 years that calls for organizations and professional bodies to rethink IT risk management processes and controls?
Okay, well, first of all, when I talk about IT risk management processes and controls, I look at it from a holistic perspective, but my area of expertise currently is within solution delivery life cycles. So a lot of things have happened, rapid development of information processing capabilities and the resulting reduction of the cost of that. We're able to store information, a lot more information than we were in the past, at a much more reduced rate. We also now have virtual machines, which we probably within the last 7 years came onto the market and really are being embraced today with regards to you can avoid having to buy a single piece of expensive equipment to run one system on. So now I can actually duplicate all my systems and environments and programs without added expense of having to buy that machine and maintain it ongoing. I can do, as a result of this, all virtual machines. You have the introduction of infrastructure as a service, particularly in the cloud, but even if you have public or private clouds. But what happens is that we've eliminated the need for the business to make huge investments in infrastructure to explore and test new ideas and new service offerings. Most importantly, it allows us to have almost instantaneous sharing of real-time information on a level that we never experienced before. This allows us to do better decision-making at an enterprise level. So if you take the example of organizations that are global and departments that are, you know, halfway across the world, they can both look at information, get together and make decisions about what's the next best step to do. We have really rapid development and expansion of mobile devices and the supporting infrastructure. What that does is it sets all of the expectations for instantaneous response, rapid change, and constantly new functionality, which is expected by everyone, from five-year-olds right through to, some octogenarians who use it today. Information technology is an essential part of everyday life, not just work or school. Everybody expects to be able to do their business, be it for the organization they work for or their private business, anywhere, anytime. The last thing I think that I've got here is the creation of tools that support automation and software development that go beyond version control. So most of us say, we recognize the need for version control and it's really important. And we know which version we're putting out into production. But what we have now is we can automate our builds, we can automate our tests, we can provision environments, we can deploy solutions, and we can roll back if it's all required. It speeds up how quickly we can deliver new solutions. It also reduces the related risks due to human error mostly, but also some automation risk, so that we're actually given the ability to trace all changes that are made to a system at any time. And once you've eliminated that whole manual intervention process. And if you look at today's technology, there's a real push to adopt agile development practices and lean operations in IT. And to do that, you require collaboration, individual interactions, working solutions, and rapid response to change over heavy processes and use of tools, functional silos, and long-term planning. So those are some of the things that have happened. Why do we have to rethink controls? Well, a lot of our controls are developed in the past 10 years on systems and processes that are basically waterfall and tied to one system, dedicated set of hardware. That's changed quite a bit. these controls that we've been using in the last, you know, over the last 10 years really sometimes can take days or weeks to complete and actually slow down our capabilities and introduce greater overall risk to businesses in the grand scheme of thing. When you think of, if I have the technology to make a change within the next hour and the control process that's been put in place requires me to wait 4 days for approval, what good is that to the business? So that the whole heavy-handed change management process and also the whole thing about segregation of duties within solution delivery are controls that no longer work for this type of technology. We, as IT risk professionals, have to lose sort of the dogmatic approach of applying, this is the way I learned what the controls are, and this is the way and how to apply them. It's generally accepted, therefore you should use them. But what we have to do is we have to be more flexible and creative and use that technology that allows us to deliver change faster and faster to also provide the visibility and transparency into what's going on. We need to emphasize changes in behavior, the human behavior, to support the basic tenets of good IT governance, which is sort of the good decision-making based on real and not speculative information, providing transparency into decisions and what are the outcomes of the resulting actions from those decisions, and providing the support to manage IT activities in a manner that delivers value to the organizations. So I always tell them that we need to fall back on the principles and concepts of applying control for IT, the transparency, the visibility in what's happening by applying appropriate access and authorization, approvals, monitoring, and reporting, reviews, et cetera, to match the technology that you're using today.
So what are continuous delivery and DevOps, and why should we care?
So continuous delivery is basically an approach in delivering solutions that reduces the risk time of delivering what you call incremental changes to users. So you're doing continuous delivery when you have the capability for your software to be released through its life cycle. So it doesn't matter at any point in time when you look at the software, the functionality, you have a really high level of confidence that it's going to work in your production systems. Your team prioritizes keeping the software releasable over working on new features. So the focus is not on, you know, speed of delivering new features. It's focuses on, does this software work in production? Another sort of characteristic we say of continuous delivery is anybody on a delivery team can get fast automated feedback on the production readiness of the systems anytime somebody makes a decision to change them. So, you know, instead of saying, I want to try this new feature and it's going to take, you know, anywhere between 2 weeks and 2 months to see if it actually works, you break it down into small enough components that you can say, minimal viable product on this feature, what would it look like? And develop that concept within a day or two and know that the changes you made to what we call our deployment pipeline will actually work through production, and you can actually push that out and test it someplace to see if it's actually what you want and will it give you the business outcome or is it leaning towards providing the business outcome that you expect. You should be able to perform push button releases on any version of the software on demand. So this is a concept where the business owner would come up and say, the new feature that we talked about, is it ready to go? The team would say, yes or no. No means it's probably not going to happen, but yes is, yes, it goes to production. It can go to production if you want. And it involves also technical, or a great deal of technical discipline, if I can say, put it that way. But the value of having that capability to say, we're ready to go today with this functionality that we have very high level confidence know is going to work is tremendous in a highly competitive market. It leverages some of the technology I mentioned earlier, But what I really want to emphasize is that having the capability to release your solution or your software, whatever you want to call it, your service, is not the same as actually having to release it continuously. So what we say is that the business then, what it does then is the business makes a decision of when it's released, and it's not the business waiting for IT anymore. It almost turns around where IT waits for the business to say, okay, release. So that's continuous delivery. One of the things that it is heavily reliant on to make this successful is DevOps. So think of the term DevOps, and that's development plus operations. DevOps, I sort of refer it to as a culture more than a practice, but some people call it a practice, but it really is about collaboration between development groups, so your traditional software development engineers or developers, whatever they want to call themselves, and along with the testers and, iteration managers, that team, the project team, to collaborating with operations groups, your traditional, systems administrators, DBAs, network guys, all those people working in cooperation to say, being able to have the capability to say, this system is ready to go to production and we all have a really high level of confidence that it's going to work. So traditionally, development and operations, totally segregated, and what happens is development goes, okay, talk to the business, and we've cut all this really nice code and designed this whole system, and it works in theory. Here, operations, take that, put it into production, and make it work. And the operations guys go, they get it, and they go, what is this? This is just not very good. A bunch of stuff is going to make me spend a lot of my weekend time and late evening calls, early morning calls, even worse, because it's not going to work. And usually what happens is something gets pushed into production systems, and then there's, a 2-month, 3-month warranty period where they work out the major kinks, but there's always all sorts of little bugs, issues to be resolved, and actually flaws in the way the system was coded and designed that create a lot of extra work for the operations guys. So in DevOps, kind of say it's about collaboration between those teams, and it involves a lot of the automation. It involves a lot of automation of the testing of the changes, not only on the code level, but also on the infrastructure configuration level to make sure that it's going to be working in production. So it isn't just, is the code good? It becomes, is the system going to be good in production? And collaboration, testing, automation, developing the concept of a deployment pipeline that actually says, what's the configuration of everything that is needed to go into production? And if we change one element there, we run it through a series of tests, and we'll be able to tell if it's going to break anything. So when you think about operating systems, database changes, network changes, you could all put this into deployment, an automated deployment pipeline, and test each change incrementally as they're made. Even a security patch could go in there to see if it's going to break anything in your major applications. So this is all part of DevOps. And it's that culture of collaboration and sharing, but it's also referred commonly to the skills needed to do the automation and develop the deployment pipeline. So when we put all this together, if you think of it and string it all together, what happens is that you could lose the whole concept of having projects to do system upgrades. You could also lose the whole concept of having business as usual support, in that in continuous delivery and DevOps, it is if you build it, you break it, you fix it.
So what are common practices that prevent organizations from getting value delivery in software and technology?
Oh, there's so many. I could go on and on. But I'm going to try and break it down into sort of the people, process, and tools concept. And I'll give you the major ones that we see that commonly prevent organizations from moving forward. And a lot of these made sense in maybe times when organizations could afford to wait a year or two, or even 6 months before delivering new functionality to some of their services that they offer, but they don't work today. And they certainly, actually most of them, reduce the capability of people collaborating together. So when we look at people-related practices, the first one that we see is quite significant in larger organizations is you have disparate groups working on features for the same products. So this is a concept where, I could have, for example, my core team working on my home office, and then I have another team working in operations, say across the continent or on the other side of the globe. Then I have another team that's helping with the development of the features, and that has been contracted out to a development organization, perhaps again on another part of the continent, and where there's no control on actually how the features are being developed there. And they're all supposed to talk to each other and understand how the decisions that they're making on a day-to-day basis will affect how that solution or the service that they're working on will work in production. And that's just, it doesn't work. It presents all sorts of challenges in trying to keep the communication channels open and understanding, again, as I said, if I make a decision today, how is it going to affect that service down the line in production? Part of this comes from treating solution delivery itself and the people involved in that as a fungible asset, in that I could get a developer off another continent, say if I'm in the global north, I could get somebody from what I would call the global south to work at, 50% of the cost. And therefore, I'm going to do that. But what it doesn't do is it doesn't measure the value of having somebody on site working with the team that is going to be supporting and operating that system. And so, yes, I get each unit is what it costs me less, but in order to get real value, I may have to have 4 or 5 times the number of units to make it work. And there's no visibility into the value of that decision to look at it, a developer is a developer is a developer, no matter where they're located. When not measuring the value, what actually happens is it costs you more in the end, and your original intent was to reduce costs. So that's another thing that, really prevents us from moving forward and getting the value and delivery of software. We create teams of functional silos within IT. And so what I mean by functional silo is you will have a development team. So here's my software engineers. I may have a functional silo for testing. I will have another functional silo for all my infrastructure needs. I have another functional silo for my production support or BAU. So what happens is that each of those functional silos start to optimize the processes for their function alone. And what they don't do is you don't get that. If I make a decision within my functional silo, for example, if you want my services for, say, a DBA on any one project or for production support, you put your request into a queue and I will assign the next DBA that comes up with it. Now, I know that a lot of development teams even work that way, in that I have a request for a new feature. It's going to go through on this project or in this iteration, even if we're talking about Agile. And it just waits in the queue. Somebody picks it up, and then they work on it, and then they throw it over the wall to the next one. So we get lots of waiting and batching and optimization for the function and not for the organization as a whole, and how can we move this along faster. Another big one is apathetic business owners. They just say, I don't understand IT. You guys get it done. And please don't bother me when it comes to making important decisions about whether this works or not. Just talk to my BAs that I may have on my team, or maybe even the BAs reside within IT. But it's actually the business owner who should be making the decision, is delegating it down to a level where they feel that they don't have the knowledge to make the decisions, or they make the decision worse. They make the decision and then they get reamed out because it wasn't the right one. And really, it should be the business owner who's participating in that whole delivery of the service and leading the team in making the decisions. I alluded to just earlier about decisions being made at the wrong level by people who will not be held accountable or responsible for the results. So a classic one is having an architecture team that makes all the decisions about how any systems, new systems coming in, will be designed, and what even they talk about what tool sets development teams can use, what type of infrastructure they can use, and really focus more on here's a design document, follow that, than sitting down and working with the team and being held accountable. So if we made a decision to use this type of technical architecture and it's not working, I don't have to deal with it, because really all that my job to do is do the original design up front and not to worry about the problems as they are presented into production. And I'm not measured on that. I'm measured on the number of documents and projects that I produce design for. I'm not measured on whether that actually delivers the outcome that we were expecting from a business perspective. So that leads me into processes. So those are all the people-related ones. The processes ones are more about, we're going to follow a process to get this done, because that's what being effective and efficient is about. And what we tend to do with processes, we'll back and we'll use processes that are defined in ITIL and PMBOK or by PMI, even agile processes, some people get quite dogmatic about them. And it really is, we focus on the speed, how fast we can deliver things, at the expense of what is the value and the sustainability of the process. So is it working? Let me just pull back there for a minute. So the process actually is focusing more on the volume of how many people follow the process, how many activities do we push through the process. It doesn't really focus on the outcomes of the process. So if I have something like a change management process, and my regular indicators that I am reporting on is how many changes did we push through, how many were approved, how many were not pushed through. And really what we should be focusing on is not, how many people follow the change management process and how many filled out all of the documents correctly before we could give approval. It really should be, did a change break anything? And if it did, why did it break it? And it's really easy to measure quantity, as in I had this number of changes, but it's really difficult to measure the outcome. And I said, for something like change management, that should be pretty darn easy. For something like solution delivery, it really is, did the solution deliver the business results that were expected? And everybody should be measured on that. Everybody from the architects right through to the business as usual team, if you've got that happening. In process, we tend to use long feedback cycles. So what happens, particularly in solution delivery, is that we traditionally, it looks like build the code, developers build the code. Does it compile? Yes. Are all my libraries good? Yes. And that they'll go through that. But what they don't do is they'll wait, you know, 2 weeks even before they do that. And then it gets thrown over to testing to do the functional testing and maybe some of the non-functional testing like performance or security or something. And because developers probably take them, you know, 80, 85%, 90% of the time, testers are left with 10% of the time to actually say, is it working? So one of the things you need to do is get those feedback cycles shorter and build the quality in the product from the ground up. So when we talk about continuous delivery, it is developers commit their code at least once daily. If it breaks the build, everything stops. And if you know, if I've got everybody committing daily, I've got a limited number of changes that I have to go through to say what actually broke that. And with continuous delivery, when you have one developer doing it one change at a time, one very small incremental change at a time, you get almost instantaneous feedback. Did it work? Yes. Did it not work? Then you go back and you fix it until it works. So you're not allowed to introduce any errors or breaks or bugs at all. So from the ground up, you have the quality built in. So that's one thing about processes, getting that really early feedback cycle, and that requires that you work in small enough chunks of work that you can actually submit them one change at a time, one small change at a time, and say, is that change right? Yes, everything's still working. Okay, we can move on and maybe build on that change. And that is about getting the shorter feedback cycles. Talked about, you know, building things up and doing too much at once. Trying to do too much at once is a major problem for many people. Focusing on one thing at a time, getting your feedback cycle, did it work? Yes. What that allows you to do is that when you focus just on one thing, you don't have waste time changing your context. And so typically, if a developer works on a feature and maybe waits 3 to 5 days before they submit it into the build, and they go, oh, it didn't work, something broke, they have to go back and figure out what they did in the last 5 days, try to remember to think, how could it have broken? And there's a lot more work to sift through. So again, that introduces a lot of inefficiencies and also more errors. It's not very effective to build things up and do batching and trying to do too many things at one time. So one time, early feedback cycles, very small amount of work. That's the process. We fail at tools quite a bit because what happens when we're in IT, because we're all technologists, we tend to jump to tools first and think if I just get the right tool in, it's going to make everything better. So very common what I see is fixing a problem by wrapping another solution or tool set around it instead of dealing with root cause. So testing is a really good example. If I could just automate my regression tests, I won't have, you know, I will fix testing because the regression tests will get it. Well, the problem isn't the regression tests. They will help quite a bit in the end. But what you need is testing at all levels of the delivery cycle. So your developers should be doing unit tests to say, does the functionality that I've built here today, is it actually going to work the way it's set up in the requirements? You do small incremental tests on the functionality as it starts to develop. You do integration tests, not in a big bang finale before you move things into production. What you do is you stub out different systems within your testing environments, and you test, say, messaging going across back and forth between systems before it gets into a final big integration with maybe 10 other systems. So you're testing system to system, one-to-one relationship, rather than trying to do many-to-many at the very end. And it's not to say that you would not do final integration tests many-to-many at the very end, but what happens is when you build that testing in before you actually get to the end, it's the quality of what's reaching the end is much higher, and it's much less likely to fail at the very end. So you're actually increasing your chances of things working much better at the very end when you have the final time crunch. When you do continuous delivery, this is built in automatically. So all your testing is automatic at the right level. And it's done within hours. You don't even, or even minutes, depending on the system. You don't have to hold things up and wait 3-4 weeks for everything to get done. And wrapping another solution around it, you know, I talked about testing. Another one I saw that just boggled my mind was a very large enterprise telco that had a customer relation management system that wasn't working. So what they did is they went out and they bought yet another customer management, customer relationship management system to wrap around the first one without removing the second one, or without removing the first one. They just wrapped another one around it saying, there, it'll work better. So what they were doing is they didn't look at the root cause at all. Like, why did this first one fail? And it's basically due to bad design and bad implementation and not having the right business outcomes clear in their mind. They just put another one on top and spent just a horrendous amount of money on it, and it still doesn't work. And now all the customer service agents, when you talk to them, they're actually looking at two different customer relation systems and trying to figure out where the match is with your accounts. It doesn't work. With tools, we tend to tightly couple systems together, so we create these interdependencies that are really, really hard to sever in the future. And what we have to do, and this goes back to designing systems, is get them more loosely coupled. So if I need to pull one out, there's a business need to pull one out. For example, if we took that customer relation management system, I could have easily pulled it out and put in a new one in its place that was implemented in a much more reasonable way. But what we do is we tie them so closely together, we don't think about what's going to happen if I have to take this away. So what happens is we get all this bloat, we call it, in IT, where I've got systems upon systems upon systems that have to maintain, you know, the software and the hardware licensing, plus the support and maintenance, because I can't take it out. I don't even know what's going to break if I take it out. And we have to work on a way to slowly, over a period of time, build systems around this that are going to allow, that's just pull out portions of all the old legacy systems until you finally have it freed and remove it. But it's very costly and expensive to do that. And then the last one on tools is that I've seen very, very often is thinking that standardizing the tool sets for solution delivery is the best way to do things because it will save us costs and licensing and training people. And really, with solution delivery, we know that it's definitely not a one-size-fits-all, that it would be better to allow the teams who are actually working on the solution delivery have to maintain it over extended periods of time to choose the best tool to support that. And sometimes there are efficiencies that you can create by within certain tool sets, but it would almost be better to have an option of different types of tools that people could choose and say, in this case, here's the preferred one, but always leave yourself open to new suggestions because tool sets change so quickly that and the advantages of being able to put in a new tool set, and again, that goes back to having systems that are not tightly coupled, can be quite tremendous from an operations and support point of view. So people's process and tools, lots of things we do. We think in the beginning that they're really good ideas at the time. Some of them have developed over many, many years, perhaps decades, and it's time to rethink some of these concepts, particularly relates to solution delivery.
So can you sort of quickly summarize, maybe within a few minutes, how we can evolve IT processes and controls so we can deliver better value in the use of technology?
Oh, yeah. It's not... I guess the key word there is evolve the processes. So when we build a process, it needs to be flexible. And I think the common error I see by many people who use ITIL or are using processes that, for risk management is that they're not flexible. So many organizations, particularly larger ones, for the sake of trying to be efficient, will say, here's the process, everybody follows it. And there's no room to maneuver or go outside that process with the people who have developed it and the people who actually maintain it and maybe the custodians, the people who actually implement it and are responsible for making sure that it's followed. So what happens is that people are people and they find ways to circumvent it. So I think that when we look at an IT process like change management or solution delivery processes, and I look at those quite, or even access management, it is, you need to have flexibility to say, in certain circumstances, there is a very good reason for not following the process. And if you've bought that reason, come talk to us and we'll figure out what we can do to help make it work for you. So rather than encouraging people to work around you because you say, if you don't follow the process, it's going to whack you with a big stick. It's more like, okay, we recognize that this is sort of a generic guideline, doesn't fit everybody, but we would like to work with you to find out what controls can be put in place and what's the best process for what you're trying to achieve that will allow us to apply some control and get the visibility into what's going on, rather than saying, follow my process or like I'm going to whack you. So the other thing is that we need to look at processes from the end-to-end product delivery perspective. So, or service perspective, if you want to put it that way. So if I have a product that, and I'll take financials because this is probably a really good one. We often look at the IT processes around our financial systems in segregation. So here's the processes around the billing systems, here's the processes around the procurement and supply chain management, and here's the processes for accounts payable, accounts receivable. You know, what we fail to do is we look at how do we link all those from end to end, and what do the controls look like over that entire service delivery? And it goes back to the same thing we do with people. We look at things in functional silos. We look at the controls in functional silos as well. So, and really what we need to do is look at our processes with controls from the end-to-end service delivery perspective. So if I make a decision about who has access to the systems on the infrastructure and database level, I can actually see how that will affect the business's ability to get their work done. And that is really the key, is to look at how is this supporting the business and how will that decision to apply a control affect that business ability or our capability to deliver the business. We often forget that when we're in IT and we're looking at IT risk. We forget that controls should not inhibit our ability to do the business that we're in. And for this reason, we're often seen as being very restrictive, and people tend to avoid us. And when they hear about processes and controls, they cringe and immediately think about a way to work around them. So flexible, allow different paths based on the amount of risk involved. Don't look at it as a one-size-fits-all. We need to stop saying no and start saying yes. Let's see how we can make this work. So we have to, you know, focus on the people, not so much on the process and tools. And I say develop that sense of trust where we stop forcing concepts like segregation of duties and technology solution delivery just because it creates silos and waste and also a sense of mistrust and alienation from the very people that we are depending on to make things happen and reduce risks. So your job is to reduce risk by following these activities, but I don't trust you, so I'm going to put a bunch of controls in place to prevent you from making decisions that could actually deliver better value to the business and reduce the risk. So it's better to focus on sort of creating the visibility and transparency through sharing a knowledge of what's going on and getting it up there and open, and taking an approach in our processes that we're and controls that we're going to trust you to do the right thing, and then verify it through monitoring and performance monitoring of the systems and applications, business performance monitoring as well, and also we'll probably have some security monitoring in there as well. But we're going to trust you to make the right decision. So that's what processes should be focused on. And not so much like, this is the way you have to do it. Here's our rules.
I'm not sure if this is possible in five sentences or less. How can an organization get started in continuous development and DevOps?
Oh, long journey. It largely depends. If you're a small organization, greenfields, it's a lot easier because you don't have a lot of legacy technology to work with. If you got a lot of legacy technology and you're a big organization, globally dispersed, it's going to be a bit of more of a challenge. So when we talk about small organizations, greenfields, you know, you can get off from the get-go because you just set your systems up and you start your, if you start your design correctly, and fully automated everything from the beginning, you're well on your way. Larger organizations, it goes back to considering the people first and starting with the culture. So that requires fearless leadership. So oftentimes what I see is people are really interested in continuous delivery DevOps. I can intuitively see their eyes, you know, their eyes light up because they say, oh man, if we could just do this, we would get so much benefit from it. But nobody's willing to stick their neck out and say, let's give it a go. And in the executive level, there's nobody willing to say, you know what, we're going to try and make this happen. And what we have to do is completely isolate one of our, you know, business critical applications or service that we provide and give a team that looks at the service from end to end and give them, empower them to make the decisions that may result in some mistakes, and we're gonna accept that there may be some mistakes. And that requires a really fearless leader. And I'm finding that there's not a lot of them around, particularly in larger organizations. Although we work with some clients who have this fearless leadership. And the nice thing about continuous delivery is that you can break it off into small chunks, where you can get you have low hanging fruit where you can get real benefits like automating deployment of servers, you know, so you don't have to have manual intervention or deployment environments onto virtual servers or using cloud services. There's real tangible, measurable financial impact on that you can do. It requires a bit of training, or hiring organizations who have done it before to help you, but it can be done. We always say, you know, there's several different ways. You can take it like, I have an immediate concern and I want to get this done. So you hire the professionals to come in and do it for you. And hopefully you combine them, some of your own people on the team, that they can pick everything up and run with it after your experts leave. Okay. So that works well in an isolated system or service. If you want to do an enterprise-wide one, you can do sort of the coaching approach where you bring in the experts. They work with a variety of teams in your organization and for a certain length of time. And they coach and mentor, you know, teach your people on the ground, on the delivery teams, how to acquire the skill sets and the knowledge to actually do continuous delivery. Now, that takes much longer. That's a 2 to 3 year journey. And then the last one is actually where you just do it on your own, which and you're going to again do it enterprise wide, and you start very small, changing the culture where you actually try and get people to improve collaboration. And then over a period of time, you start introducing the concepts. On a corporate level, global, this is very, very hard to do, and it'll probably be a 5-year journey. And quite frankly, most organizations don't have that amount of time left.
Okay, we're down to our last one or two, maybe three questions, and the end of the interview, and we're going to switch directions here. And on this question, it's about computing. You know, computing has been around for, you know, 4 or 5 decades, and in sort of a meaningful way. Do you think that computing should be a recognized profession on par with accounting, medicine, or law, with demonstrated professional development, adherence to the code of ethics, personal responsibility, public accountability, quality assurance, or recognized credentials?
No. I think that there's room for that at a professional level, yes. I think that we need to have professionals recognized as people who have a very good background in knowing what is the right thing to do versus how to do things right and when to apply that knowledge. The ethics around a profession, I think, are really important. Discipline is extremely important, too. To make something like continuous delivery work within an organization requires a great deal of discipline. So my short response is yes, and then my longer response is that you don't want to make it so restrictive, and that in order to be able to work as a developer, you must have these credentials. And the reason being is that what you tend to get is that mob mindset, if you could put it that way, where there's no continuous injection of new ideas, new ways of thinking. The organization I work for is quite certification adverse, if I can put it that way. We hire a lot of really, really bright people who look at things differently and come up with very unique, elegant solutions as a result. But from their perspective, is like, certification doesn't prove that I'm a competent professional. And that is probably what I'm trying to get to. So, you know, I know you can make the argument that, you know, doctors are certified or regulated or, you know, professionals, and there still are bad doctors. But at least you have an understanding of what the basic knowledge level and skill set experience required to get that professional designation. So the concept is that should be a baseline that you work from, but it shouldn't be the end of it. Does that make sense?
Okay, so we've got about another couple of minutes left in the time I've been allocated for this interview. So very quickly, you know, you've done a lot of speaking, traveling, and working. Do you maybe have one story that's of interest? You know, something amusing or amazing, unexpected?
Unexpected. So I got to tell you what I did at age 56. I resigned or retired from the job that I had, and I had worked exclusively in Western Canada, and we packed up our bags and we moved to Australia. So I'm thinking, Australia, great country, lots of sunshine. I know the language, shouldn't be too bad to move there. But when you get here to live, it's kind of like complete disorientation. You know, you're in a new city, you're supposed to live there. I don't even know the main streets of the downtown district. You know, it takes me 2 weeks to figure out which way is west because I can't see the mountains anymore. and then the true culture shock I found was not, you know, different languages, signs and that sort of thing, although, you know, those make it difficult. But it's more like going to the grocery store and getting molasses. I want molasses. Where's molasses? And the clerk's looking at you like you've got snakes coming out of your head because they don't use the term molasses. You know, it's something completely different here. You think it's treacle. And you kind of go, it's those sorts of things that completely catch me off guard constantly because I'll say, where's the blah? And they all look at me like, what is she talking about? And we're all speaking the same language, but it's still about, comes down to communications. You know, it just blows my mind constantly.
And we're down to our final question, and that is, if you were conducting this interview, what one question would you ask, and then what would be your answer?
I'd say, what do you think is the future for organizations who don't change the way they do things to leverage the capabilities to deliver technology faster? So, you know, if I choose to remain the way I am, or I choose to take the slower route to embrace new technologies and new expectations from my customers, what's going to happen? And my response is, you're going to die. You will not be around. And it's only a matter of time. If you are a very large organization with a very large cash flow, it may take a while, but eventually, the smaller organizations that are leveraging technology will continue to nibble away at your ankles and your heels, your knees, you know. It's just like that old children's song where, you know, eventually they'll take your head away and there's nothing left. We have to leverage the capabilities of new technologies. And as IT risk professionals, which is my area of responsibility, you know, my message to everybody is you have to look at the risks, the controls, the processes, and adapt them to allow the business to leverage that technology.
Well, Joanne, thank you for sharing your many deep insights with our audience. I know they'll greatly appreciate it, and I know your schedule is pretty demanding, so it's been a great pleasure to have you come in today to do this interview.
My pleasure, Steve.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Joanne Molesky, Principal Consultant, ThoughtWorks.